Okay, go ahead.
Bounty County, everyone. This is Professor Amon-Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach. We want to welcome each and every one of you here for this very important discussion about racism and raising Black children in a racist dynamic, as well as discuss some of the perspectives that some of the guests presenters have about the beatdown and murder of Brother Tyre Nichols. And so we're going to get started. First of all, I want to welcome also our co-host, Joe Hembrick, who is a historian, longtime educator for Linwood and Compton Unified School District, the first Black head coach of football at Linwood High School District, as well as a longtime historian, where he says constantly that he got his education from Issawan bookstore and libraries as far as his relentless study on the history of African people. And not only that, just ancient history as well as religious perspectives. I want to thank Brother Rashi Key, who is the who provides this platform for this discussion. And I want to welcome those people who are in a different time zone. We have Dr. Rosemary Allen, who's a longtime community activist as well as a entrepreneur and deal with diversity in education in the Denver area, as well as she operates one of the biggest nonprofits out there. But at the same time, she helped build the Black Consciousness Conference, as well as one of the most active Black student unions at Cal State Long Beach when she where she did her undergrad work. We want to welcome Dr. Rosemary Allen, as well as Brother Reginald Muhammad, professor out there in Atlanta, as well as a longtime worker on reparations who have a doctrine on the reparations that he's proposing people to read, as well as his longtime work with the Atlanta community, as well as Florida. I mean, he's just all over there, and we want to thank him for his valuable time. We have Principal Rao, who's a longtime educator and former principal of the U, one of the most progressive high schools that was ever part of LA Unified, which he built from the bottom up. And now he's a consultant and educator of crypto money for high schools, as well as building the Compton Legacy in Compton, a child care and educational institute for young people to build future leaders, and using his strategies and his connections, his national wide connections to facilitate that. We have also, who else is on, Rashiki?
We got Luther Keith that's going to be talking about.
Go ahead, Joe. You introduce Luther.
Yeah, everybody, I want to introduce Luther Keith Jr., also known as Boo. Long time working with gang units in Compton, South Central, and has a street ministry dealing with the homeless on Skid Row down in L.A. He's a former student of Centennial High School. Played baseball at Southern University in Baton Rouge, and is currently at King Drew High School. So, Boo, I want to introduce you, and won't you, tell us a little something about your format, because I think this other program is on something else. So,
Brother Hembrick, his audio is still connecting, so he's not going to be able to talk until that comes through.
Okay, well, go ahead on, Brother Ra.
So all right. We also have Brother Mashinda on, Professor Ra.
Well, you can go ahead and talk a little bit about Mashinda.
Okay, Brother Mashinda was born and raised in Compton. He's now in Louisiana, Bogalusa, Mandeville area. He's a college administrator and a longtime worker in the community, and just a motivator, educator.
Link.
That's Brother Mashinda. He's always on with us also for the Community Education Network organization. So he's a member and a contributor.
Okay. So, and then we have guest Alma Jackson, longtime community activist, a sustainer for the African American Culture Center, one of the most vigorous alumni archivists for Centennial High School District, and longtime activist with regards to social justice and women issues, and especially dealing with Black women and Black youth in the community. So let's go ahead and get started. And
when Professor Ra,
yeah,
we also have Linda Shorter and Sandra Henderson on.
Okay, Linda Shorter is one of the curators of a virtual museum. She's out of Florida, but she was a longtime activist in the Long Beach area, along with her brother Reginald Zahn, also Reginald Muhammad. They operated a Black bookstore in Long Beach. They've been activists, and she also worked with the Black Long Beach newspaper. And you know, she's just a one of the most knowledgeable persons and connected persons nationally with regards to relationships and working with people. So we want to thank Linda for her involvement. And who else?
Ross speaking right now.
Who else, Rasha Key, besides Linda?
Sandra Henderson.
And Sandra Henderson.
Out of Miami, a friend of Linda Shorter's.
Okay, well, we want to welcome Sandra, and we'll get to her, and she can tell us a little bit about herself as we talk, because we got to respect the people on a different time zone, and go ahead and get started. Now, Joe, you had something to say?
I done lost all the picture stuff, man. I'm trying to get Boo on here and mess myself up.
Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and get started while you're working on it. Okay, go ahead, Brother Roski. We're going to start with Dr. Rosemary Allen. Rose, are you there?
Well, just keep listening. We're going to come
I
back.
Am here.
Okay, Rose, first of all, you can talk, you know, you deal with diversity, but at the same time, you can just give us about 10-minute presentation on what you do in Denver and what do you think about, because you was working on the disproportionate amount of suspension of Black children nationwide. You've been a part of the national educational system in Washington, D.C., working with the various secretaries of education. You've been strong in education in Denver, state known and for your work and things of this nature and recognize. What do you, how do you see the aspect of racism as it deals with the discipline and the diversity of children in the Denver area and nationwide from your studies and from the projects and consultancies that you do?
Well, what we know is what we lost after Brown versus Board of Education. We know that we lost the largest population of Black teachers ever in this country. But not only did we lose them, but we lost their investment, dedication, and commitment to Black children and their future in their communities. And once we integrated, we sent our children to the enemy to be educated, which is what Malcolm X warned us about. And in doing so, over the last 45 years, we have been collecting data on how our children have been treated and disciplined in America's school systems. And 40 years of data shows us that our children are at least 4 times more likely to be suspended than white children. And those are suspensions that we measure that are self-reported. So we know that the suspension rate is much higher than we ever realized. But not only are they suspending children from kindergarten through 12th grade programs, our research shows that they start kicking our children out of childcare much, much earlier. Children are suspended, kicked out of childcare beginning at 8 months old. 8 months old for crying and biting. 8 months. But even at 8 months, Black boys are suspended more than anyone. Our Black boys are the most suspended children on the planet. Exclusionary discipline also impacts little Black girls. So Black girls are only 20% of the female preschool population, but 54% of those who are suspended from school. And again, this is self-report, so we know what's happening that's not reported. And the two main reasons for this is their sassiness, what most of us call Black girl magic, all that sass and confidence. And the second is their hair. They're suspended for the way they wear their hair, protecting people from touching their hair, all these arcane dress codes that are targeted to Black people. So we are seeing these suspensions, but not only the suspensions, but the other forms of exclusionary discipline and how our children are treated, maligned, oppressed, and traumatized in our school district. And go ahead.
Rose, what do y'all do to try to stop that?
Well, we are training teachers all over the country. I have worked with the U.S. Department of Ed and every Department of Ed in the country, except for Alaska and Hawaii and South Dakota. We used to do like a one and done training every quarter, but now we conduct an equity audit where we go in and audit the school district's processes from their wonderful DEI statements that they created after the murder of George Floyd, to their personnel practices, to their pay equity practices, to their discipline records that we look at. And so we do an audit of the entire system, and then we give them recommendations, and then we provide training over years, because we know that you can go into a training and nothing changes. And then we conduct audits at the first year mark, second year mark, and then at the third year mark. And we determine where they are with their equity, where they are with their suspensions. For instance, we collect a lot of data around suspensions and where they happen. So we have this program where we have the teachers use it, and they document what kind of incident happened, where it happened, what time it happened, who was involved, the teacher, the time of day, and all of the racial demographics. And for instance, in Oregon, we found that most of the suspensions in this elementary school happened at recess on the basketball court. So then the question is, what's happening at the basketball court at recess? And we found out that the aides were in charge of the playground, so most of them didn't know the children. And this is an all Black school, and mostly Black students, mostly white staff. And so the aides didn't know the children, and the kids were playing street ball. You know how we play, all the fouling and talking back and all that mess. And the young white aides were terrified and thought they were going to fight. So they would accuse them of fighting, of being disrespectful, of cussing and all that. And they would get upset like, ain't nobody fighting. What you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. So now they're being defiant. You know, they love that defiant category, and they're sent to the office and suspended. So by the time we looked at the data and met with the team, we said, well, what's going on? What should we do? And the teacher said, well, I think they should play more NBA basketball at school and leave the street ball at home. So the other thing we teach them is that wherever they are, they're a guest in that community. You're a guest. You don't determine how they play. Mm-hmm. You learn how they play. Mm-hmm. And you stop being so afraid in adultifying Black boys. So we were able to help these teachers implement culturally responsive responses, learn how that community works, get out there and help hold community cafes and become part of the community so they won't be terrified of instances like this. So again, we do a lot of training around that.
Okay, well, Rose, stay on for a minute, because I'm going to come back to you. Brother Reginald Muhammad? Reginald, you there?
Yes, sir, Professor Ra.
Oh, well, you're in Atlanta.
Yes, sir.
And you're dealing with a lot of issues with young people out there. What are some of the challenges you see with regards to how they treat young people and how they educate young people and how, you know, the family structures that you think have an impact on young people with regards to racism and discrimination.
Thank you, Professor Rod. Thank you for all of you all who are on tonight and the insight that you bring. From my vantage point, remember, too, I'm first a student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And one of the things, Professor Rod, that you will know that when we say that we have a problem with our youth, whether it be gang violence, whether it be teenage pregnancy, whether it be juvenile the delinquency, the breakup of the family, anything that we allow the enemy to say is a problem, or sometimes we say it is a problem, we see it as the results of our problem. And how do you start to stem the tide? One of the first things, no matter what class I'm teaching, Professor Rye, if it's the politics and global issues that I teach, if it's state and local government, if it's contemporary political thought, any of these classes that I've taught and I am teaching, I first must start with the knowledge of self. And so how do we start to stem the tide and turn it around, Professor Rod, where we start to offset some of the problems that we're having, especially with Black boys and their response to themselves, to the community, and their home? We know that there's the decimation of the Black family. Dr. Doctor's name that just came off? She talked about
Dr. Allen.
Thank you so much, Dr. Allen, for your comments and helping lay the foundation of the discussion. Because one of the things we know that integration hurt us. And what we're seeing now, Professor Ra and Dr. Allen, remember Dr. Nathan and Julia Hare, they saw this 40 years ago. If you go back and read The Endangered Black Family, you read The Crisis in Black Sexual Politics, and you'll see that they, and Dr. Welsing's and her brilliant work in 1992, the ISIS papers, they foresaw where we are today. They saw it coming and were able to predict it. So when you got a situation with the Black family being decimated and moms doing all they can, doing double time and doing double work. And so now we're seeing the results of the problem, and that problem is a breakup of the Black family. How do we offset that? How do we start to deal with what Dr. Karinga called the culture crisis? Well, first off, we got this at every institution, every turn, every corner we're at, we got to start to teach a knowledge of ourselves. That way, number one, we start to fall in love with who we are. We start to be self-respecting, self-determining, self-developing, and self-defending of ourselves and our people. And so that knowledge of self is best defined as the knowledge of God, your own nature, the history of the Black nation, and all the sciences. So if you say that we have had a level of success in the Nation of Islam, Professor Rod, with some of the brothers and sisters that you have trained and worked with over the last 40, 50, 60 years, it always goes back. If the brother has a drug problem, if he's in poverty, if it is a family, if it's a breakup of the family, he's been traumatized. What is it that we're doing that has caused us to be successful in that realm with dealing with youth and dealing with our students and our children, youth and otherwise male and female? It's teaching them the knowledge of self. Because again, when you fall in love with yourself, you'll do for self, you'll respect yourself, you'll determine for yourself, and you will speak for yourself and define yourself and develop and defend for yourself. And so with that in mind, Professor Rob, every day, no matter what the class I'm teaching every semester, let's start off with the knowledge of self and then start to give them some foundational pieces. So that way, again, Professor Rob, it's not hard to deal with the fact that our children are not so quick to fight and kill each other. Give an example based on where you live, what color you're wearing. When you have a knowledge of self, you realize that human life is valuable. You realize that our humanity matters. You realize, Professor Roth, that this young man was killed, Tyree Nichols, by supposedly five Black officers. And so what is that about? To a degree, that level of self-hatred that we have for each other, when you don't have a knowledge of yourself, Professor Rod, you can put on a uniform, you can have degrees in every discipline, but you're missing the first degree, the knowledge of self. So you end up being a tool by perpetuate the same thing that white supremacists, the wicked white supremacists have perpetuated on us, and the destruction that we did on each other and what they have heaped up on us. We perpetuate that because, again, lacking that knowledge of self. Because again, Professor Rod, you'll know if a young man or a young woman really has the knowledge of self, well, how we talk to each other, how we respect each other.
I'm
not going to kill each other.
I'm going to get back to you on that knowledge of self, because there's so much resistance.
Okay.
To young people when you try to teach them the knowledge of self. But I'm going to get into that.
And yes, sir.
Not that they're resisting knowingly. It's the subliminal suggestions, seductions that the system tried to use to captivate them to see themselves other than as African or Black, or as the knowledge of who they are from the Nation of Islam perspective also. But I'm going to come right back to you. Brother Principal Brown, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Oh, there you are.
Okay, brother, Principal Ra, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Right, now you started a school called the U, and you've been dealing with young people as a principal, one of the most successful schools in the LA Unified School District, a high school where you had no fights, had a lot of attendance, but at the same time, you started a projects of different houses and stuff as a salute, and you seem to be able to get Latinos and African Americans to work together. Tell us a little bit about OSG and well as your formula for schools that you revolutionized and that you're going around the country teaching them about restorative justice and all those things.
Yeah, no, thank you. And thank you for everybody for allowing me to be in community with you. So for those who don't know me, I'm Principal Raw. I'm the youngest of Professor Amin Raw. I was a founder of University Pathways Public Service Academy. I was a founding principal, and we elevated the school to have two back-to-back 100% graduation rates. We had 90% of our students accepted to four-year universities. We had zero fights and zero suspensions and zero expulsions during the 5 years that I was there, because we developed a framework, and personally, I developed a framework that can actually touch the hidden treasure of every kid, right? And if you know anything about Watts, you know that we had people from the Jordan Down Projects, Nickerson Gardens, Florence 13, MSA, all come together. But what's really powerful, and both of the previous speakers talked to this, but I'm going to really talk about how we have to be intentional and we have to be explicit when it comes to the knowledge of self. But also there's two things that we must understand at what history has taught us. History has taught us that media has social engineered self-hate, right? Sure, media has constructed self-hate. And when we think about how media has played a real dire role to the disenfranchise of communities and families, we have to be intentional around how public-private partnership work, which means that my father always taught me that the primary source of education comes from the household. So what we did at our school, we developed a sense of belonging for all kids. And we developed a sense of belonging, and we gamified the learning experience for kids that made them come to school and empowered them with a sense of autonomy over if you want to play music, all right, we built a music studio. If you wanted to go into entrepreneurship, we developed a studio for that. But more importantly, what we did was we created, our mission was for every student to self-actualize. What does that mean? They had to self-actualize with the ability to once those two things are interconnected, you then start building a recipe for success. And what I've done is catapulted me to be an executive coach with superintendents and districts. We're applying a framework in which we have helped Clark County in Vegas decrease one of their elementary schools from having over 600 referrals in 1 year to down to 86 in 1 year. Right? How did we do that? Is that we first started with community. Many districts across the country talk about restorative justice and they implemented it wrong. You know, like I always tell people, you can't restore a relationship that was never built. In many schools prior to COVID, prior to that, they weren't trauma-informed before COVID, and now they tried to be trauma-informed after. And you can't build something, you can't restore something that never was built. So first thing that we do, Professor Raw, is that we go in and we support schools and we support with a framework on what kind of community do you want? And we have to come up with an operational definition for all these broad terms that's used across education, right? Yes, we want knowledge of self, but what does that mean at the school? right? Like, well, how do we actually create a rigor, a framework to say this is when we know that our kids are self-actualized, right? How do we decrease suspensions? And how do we, it doesn't mean that we didn't have arguments at the school. It didn't mean, but our way of defining what a kid's worth is by having a conversation and for them to take self-accountability. Why do they get self-accountability? Is because they know that we're not individualistic at this school. We are a community. And when we're a community, we want each other to win. So that led me to writing a book that became an Amazon best-selling book, and it helped transform leaders across the country. And it connected me with a network in which I'm the West Coast chapter chair of, called OSG, which is Off School Grounds. And Off School Grounds is a coalition of over 150 Black principals across the country that is really coming together to try to revolutionize education. We meet up every Thursdays on Zoom, and I mentor. I'm 35. I'm like the millennial mentor to many of the principals and superintendents. But it's more important that and I want to say this, Professor Raw, it's important for us to know ourselves. It's also important, and I say this all the time, representation is valuable, but consciousness is priceless. And I think it's really important for us to have consciousness leaders. Like, we want to do teacher development, but going from the South Bronx and mentoring the principals I mentor, leadership, there's a leadership gap. Because I tell you what, you have teachers that want to do that work, but if that leader is still acting like a warden and have a warden mindset, like they're over a prison yard, then it doesn't matter how much that teacher fights, they're fighting against a brick wall. And what we're doing is we're breaking down those barriers. And another thing with knowing self, we got to understand the macroeconomics of our educational system. Currently, our system is you learn everything you can do until you're a 12th grader. Do you make money? Kids coming from where I come from, they make the biggest financial decision of their life in their senior year. And most of them take student loans out and they get and they go into a career that doesn't have a big ROI. And they borrow money to get a job that they can't even afford to pay back. Over 60% of Black wealth is tied into the student loan debt crisis in this country. Over 60%. How can we attract the financial trauma, the environmental trauma, and the social trauma all coming together in our K-12 experience for kids? And that's the framework that we have unpacked for leaders to unpack so their teachers can unpack it, so then their kids can unpack it, and then the community can thrive off of that. So I don't know if I answered your question, Professor.
Yeah, but tell them about the conference y'all got coming up in March.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing, Professor Raw, you know, I'm a founder of an edtech company called K-12 Crypto, which is a learn-to-earn platform. People don't know that, you know, incentivized education, there's a lot of research on it. There was research by Dr. Roland Fryer in 2008, where he did something called Cash for Grades. It was over 36,000 kids across the country was incentivized on their learning. It increased attendance and increased engagement, but it didn't increase test scores. However, what we found as the problem, and through the research that I've done and through me actually applying it, is that that framework, that structure of incentivized education is flawed because too many schools incentivize compliance. And compliance, this doesn't work. You know what compliance is. Come to school, sit down, be quiet, walk in a line, and follow what I say. That doesn't work when we try to do all these class dojo bucks and these points to try to incentivize compliance. Incentivized education works when the end user, who's the student, actually feels that they have a choice. Similar to many of us with credit card points or Starbucks points, we can actually have a choice. So what we did was we allow kids to earn and learn while they're in school, but they don't get access to claim that micro grant until they graduate from high school to be used as a catapult for them going into school so they won't have to go into debt. So we're doing what is called next generation financial teaching that's happening in March, and we're doing this all across the country. The next generation financial teaching is for students to be able to understand centralized finance, financial literacy, and the emerging world of technology with artificial intelligence, blockchain technology, and AR, VR. We're actually taking kids to the metaverse. We're actually allowing them experience what crypto is and blockchain, but we also letting them know the emerging world of technology with artificial intelligence and collective intelligence so they understand the good, the bad, and the ugly, so they can really be prepared in a digital entrepreneurship and a digital revolution that's happening right now. Because if we don't fight now, Professor Raw, to really understand the world that's being built around us, 20 years from now, we're going to be fighting the same fight, saying, how were we left behind? And why were we left behind? Why weren't we talking about this and how are we not involved with this? So it's my charge to be the trailblazer towards this by saying that we need more ed tech founders. We need more coders. We need more developers because we're on this platform right now and we're all using it. And I can go on and geek out about this, but
all right.
March 15th will be doing it.
Don't go nowhere because we're going to talk about racism and I want you to get into that. Brother Boo, is he there, Joe?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, brother. You do a lot of work with the homeless, brother, and youth in the homeless. And Joe has really talked about all the work that you've been doing with the schools and with the community. How do you see the youth with regards to their homeless Black youth or with regards to racism and homelessness?
Well, you got a lot of youth downtown, a lot of them stopping to watch homeless young from 16 on up. And it's sad to see all these youngsters on the streets. Most of them had a mother, father, father in prison, mother in prison, or they on some type of dope and alcohol. It's just like it's sad. When I go down every day, it's sad. You give some young folks some clothes, some food, or they strung out on the dope. It's sad. It hurts me because I'm downtown every day, 7 days a week, from Watts to Compton, all the way in front of Skid Row. And you know, you see, it's like Black and brown. You got Asians down there, young, real young. And it's so sad, you know. You got people getting out of prison. All right. You got kids, runaways from group homes, don't want to listen. They down. I saw a 14-year-old kid about maybe a year ago on a skateboard, smoking cigarettes, hanging out right there. And I'm like, he said, I left my group home because they keep messing with me in there. I say, son, you only 14 years old. These folks down here is on drugs and got fentanyl. You need to be in a place. And, you know, he's right there trying to get some weed. I had to put him to the side and say, man, go to some place. Get from down here. You know, it's sad.
So you're saying that there's a lot of different causes for each one of them young people why they're on the streets. What age groups do you see on the streets, and what are they doing to try to get them off the streets?
With ages 14, 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old, 20-year-old, come from other states, try to find a better place and get caught up in that street life. And then they raise so much money. I don't know where's the money. They've been the billions of dollars, the trillions of dollars they've been raising to get these folks off the streets, get these kids into some type of home, get them off the streets. And I'm down there every day. It's like.
We can't hear you.
On the street.
Out of prison. A water from a group home, run home. And I don't know, trying to do something, and they build all these new places, right? They're building one right here on 126 and I'm in Norway and Imperial for homeless. But they gotta have, you got to instruct these people to write and get some help for these folks. These folks don't know how to pay no rent, they don't know how to keep it clean, and they was paying these hotels. Doing everything was shut down, millions of dollars to housing folk. They didn't want to go in. Now I was down there when they had everything shut down. I had my uniform on, my mask, going down there feeding every day. You talking about folks that's hungry, needing clothes, soap, hygiene packets, brothers getting out of prison, women's getting out of prison.
Well, look here, brother. I'm going to talk to you more because I got some clothes I want to donate, and I'm pretty sure I know some other people that would be donating a lot of clothes. We just want to make sure they get to the homeless, and you'll be our point person for that. And whatever else we can do to help with regards to letting you know where there's food giveaways, and one of the things we're going to do at the Compton Legacy is have a food distribution thing. And every year we do those things. So just stay on, because we're going to talk about racism in a minute. And you growing up in Compton, okay. You know that, all right? Brother Mashinda.
All right.
Brother Mashinda?
Yes, how you doing tonight?
All right, brother. Now, you're in Louisiana. Talk to us about racism and what's going on with regards to the youth and the major issues you face in the South.
Well, before I get started on that, I just want to, you know, I enjoyed what I just heard before. I kind of dabbled in a lot of that, what I just heard, you know, and these are tough acts to follow. But you know, first and foremost, can you hear me?
Yeah. But you.
Yeah, I was born. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Compton. So, you know, through the Compton school systems, things like that. Went off to school in San Diego. And so basically, in a nutshell, just listening to everybody before I tied into the South, you know, I spent about 15 years in the criminal justice system, you know, working with gangs myself, things like that. And so seeing the construct, you know, what's going on with our children in the community, working with the gangs, they had a system set up to document gang members. And so, you know, they labeled it from peripheral gang members to hardcore. So a lot of our kids at that point got sucked into the vacuum. A lot of money was being funded into those gang units. And so therefore they needed clientele to fund that, you know, so a lot of people had good jobs and things like that. It was about 300 applicants, you know, in that department trying to get into that particular specialized unit with 20 officers. Again, like I say, I wasn't into the officer thing. You know, I didn't grow up like that per se. You know, I mean, I'm a mature adult and, you know, I respect, you know, the good law enforcement. But at the time, you know, just going into that, I was exposed to a setup. You know, our children were being put in, you know, camps in California Youth Authority and lockdown facilities where a lot of the other children, Caucasian children in particular, were going to group homes and things like that. So what I did was, you know, I became a leader, you know, moved up into positions to where I was able to advocate for our children, you know, Hispanics as well, because they were the same boat, became an expert witness on gangs in court. I was called into court a few times to speak on some gang issues and things like that. But my testimony was basically in support, doing my research and social studies on the family, bringing in their families and seeing what they were really about. I know who's hardcore and who's not. And so therefore, I was able to save a lot of kids that journey down that prison pipeline, diverted their attention on other things like education and getting their lives together. So anyway, I could talk on that, but anyway, that's one of my backgrounds. So working in education, when I moved down to Louisiana, of course, I started working in, you know, I used some of my skill sets, transferred my skill sets into education, was able to get a job in the school system. They immediately put me in as, you know, I got hired on, needed a job, got hired on as an in-school suspension instructor. Well, the first thing that when the European asked me to, you know, do I want the job and all that kind of stuff, because I had a background, I had credentials in terms of a resume to deal with that population as they thought. And the first thing European told me was I want it ran like a jail. You know, I'm like, wow, this guy's something else. So anyway, I said, I got you. What I did was immediately when I got into that classroom, you know, I basically interviewed each one of my people that came into my in-school suspension class and got their phone numbers and mother's numbers and whoever's numbers and involved them in their process, you know. And so I didn't have any, but my recidivism rate was very low in terms of them coming back to in-school suspension. I sat on four girls at one time for 4 months because they like sentenced them to in-school suspension because they were kind of doing devious things within the school. All four of them, well, with the exception of one, I must say, three of them are like supervisors on jobs and doing well. They run into me. They say, "Hey, you still working at the school?" "No, I'm not working at the school. I'm somewhere else." And they're like, "Man, they need you over there." You know, so I'm not bragging on myself per se. It's not even about that. But I just like Principal Ra, you know, I've seen some of his videos And, you know, he fires me up, you know, the U, you know, I think, man, that's incredible. You know, that's what I'm talking about. You know, I worked in juvenile hall for several years, ran units, things like that. We had a program called Success Unit, and we took the worst kids, so-called worst kids that were, you know, very dangerous or whatever, turned them into role models inside the institution. And a lot of them never returned back to the institution, you know. So, but again, just, you know, doing my part, moving down to the South, came down to the South, like I say, got the job in in-school suspension, parlayed that into another job. Well, I went back to school, got into IT. I taught information technology for 14 years. And so I used that platform. I taught information technology, but I had many sidebars on other things like Know Thyself. And, you know, it was tough because you're up against administrators who are anti-Know Thyself. They don't want you doing that. I must say, let me revert back to San Diego. I worked at an honor camp. I was there. It was 300 inmates locked down. They had bullies. They say, well, they called it an honor camp, but these are the people who afforded lawyers, and they were able to get local time. But still, you had Mexican Mafia, you had Crips Bloods, KK, you had all kinds of different guys. I got the Crips and Bloods. We created a conscious party. I took the C and the P, Crip and Piru, and changed it to conscious party. I had Crips and Pirus together in one room for about 6 weeks. We were meeting. And then the Europeans said, hey, this may create potential problems. So he wanted me to, break that down and not meet with these guys anymore, you know, that kind of thing. So the enemy doesn't want us. I think the first sister that spoke, you know, we're talking about integration, you know, and things like that. Our educational systems and our teachers and everybody broke down. So similar in criminal justice, and, you know, it's all related because it's all connected. So anyway, back to the South, I'm working in the higher education, post-secondary community college, worked the IT. Then I segued into student affairs. So working in student affairs, I started noticing about dual enrollment, you know, students that can take college classes and things like that. And what I realized overall, they have the technical track. You can get a trade or you can go to university. Well, that's good because they all, you know, they say, well, all children aren't university material. I know that Principal Rock can probably attest that, you know, most of our children are university material if that's what they want to do. But what happens is these folks, especially down here, who control the positions of power in terms of the teachers, the principals, and superintendents of these school districts, and in predominantly Black, or at least 50% Black school districts, they are dictating and controlling the narrative and the policies of what's being going on. Just like, you know, all white police departments and things like that. And so anyway, so I'm trying to get students in these high schools to get involved in our programs and things like that. You know, we have trades and we have university pathways. However, when you go over to the high schools, these local high schools that I'm dealing with, it's kind of like they're giving our kids the alternative to go to the technical track, because what happens is and it starts at the top, because the state legislature is the one who passed these laws, these bills. You know, they put it on the floor in the House and the representatives and the senators of the state level, and they pass these educational laws to where they say, okay, we can have these dual tracks. We can have the tech track. And so what's happening is the European is saying, hey, they're kind of like in real estate. I studied real estate a little bit, and they have a term in real estate called steering, you know. Like, hey, I want to live over there in Carson. I want to live in Compton. Well, I want to live in Beverly Hills, where the real estate agent will steer you to Long Beach, or steer you to Compton, or steer you where your people are, you know, which is illegal in a lot of senses. But anyway, they steer these students into the technical track. They talk, you know, they pretty much, it's my grandmother who died. She was 99 years old. And she said that she would go to the school that I work at right now. When she was, I'm talking about back in the 40s or 50s or whatever, back, you know, I work at one of the first technical colleges in the state. Now it's a community college. And my grandmother said when she went to school, she wanted to be a nurse. And when she went to sign up, they told her, so they interviewed her, they steered her to marketing. She said, they want me to work in these white folks' businesses and things like that, you know, work at the counter or do inventory or stocking or something like that. You're not that kind of material. So these constructs are in place and they're still in place. But the point is, now they're steering our students to these technical tracks. Now, at this point, it's such a dire problem with killings that's going on where I'm at that, hey, if they can get on any track, I'm happy. But the point is, if their opportunities can be much greater if this construct wasn't in place. But I'm watching it. Then there's one more thing. I know I got to go. Adult education, GED. They have the, you know, there's many of our students, many of them, because on my campus, we teach GED programs. Well, kids are just stepping out of school now. They're stepping out of school now and just going to get their GED. I mean, it's like a mass exodus out of high school and people are getting their GED. Why? Because there's bullying going on and all these other problems is going on. There's killings going on and the kids are intimidated and the leadership that don't care, is watching it or maybe not watching it. They don't care, and it's happening. And so our kids are saying, "I'm going to get my GED." Or some of them are being homeschooled. A lot of the white kids are getting homeschooled, though none of our children. You know, I don't even know any of our children are getting homeschooled, but they are taking these kids out of these public schools because of the fact that there's nobody minding the store. There's nobody caring. These people, the people that they have minding the store are people that are ready to retire. So they'll take these jobs as a principal or somewhere else so they can get a higher paycheck because they're in teacher retirement, and then they can retire and go on home to glory or do whatever they want to do. So I'm saying is,
go ahead. We're going to come back to you about that steering in education because, you know, that's a very important point that you're making. And we're going to get back to you on that. So hold on, because we want
to talk
about the racist dynamic in a minute. Brother Kumba, are you there?
Kumba? Yes, sir, I'm here.
All right, you're director of that. But I think there's a creek in Denver. Is that right? What is it? Yes. You're breaking up a little bit, but go ahead. Tell us about what you would do with diversity and one of the reasons they have a diversity program. Why is it needed?
First of all, it's an honor to just be in the space with some great educators. And Cherry Creek School District, you know, Dr. Allen is out here with me and in the state of Colorado. Probably knows a lot about Cherry Creek School District. And Cherry Creek School District is a very unique district because it has a lot of our African brothers and sisters, our Black brothers and sisters, our a large immigrant and refugee population, and then it has a traditional white population. And when you bring all those different groups together, the district decided that they need a diversity office, which is the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Community Engagement, to look at these things and figure out where is disproportionality is taking place. We have an equity framework that we work with, which I find to be unique in a school district, and that I also find helps me with working with schools. Systems, our equity framework comprises systems and structures, or dismantling systems and structures that negatively impact particular groups, uplifting racial consciousness personally and within your workspace, cultural humility, and culturally responsive education, looking at the pedagogic models that are in the classroom. So with that type of framework, what I'm able to do is go to a school who knows the framework, know they're supposed to be operating within the framework, and I can ask, what is the data telling you in your school? Based on that, what are the systems and structures we need to dismantle? Based on that, how are you uplifting racial consciousness? Based on that, how are you respecting the cultures that are represented in your building? And how are you making this an equitable learning environment for all? So that's the work that I get a chance to do daily. And with that, I'm able to advocate for families who may be having some trouble within the district, ref is dealing with suspensions and expulsions, or figuring out how do I go in this meeting and my child is having issues, do I need an advocate in there so I'm able to advocate for them? So for me, my work is do the work I do in the community now, I can bring to the classroom. So that's just a brief overview of what I do. And So I know we're short on time, got a lot going on, but that's the framework we work with. That's what we do in the district. And that's how we help schools within the district. Over 55,000 students in the district. And we have six different high school feeders. So that's the middle schools, the elementary schools, and now preschool, since it's mandatory in the state of Colorado, that we help with throughout the academic year.
Okay, well, what about the well, we're going to come back to you because, you know, that young man that had the mask on and that they beat to death.
Elijah McClain. Now, that's my NAACP hat, and we have a lot that we're dealing with that case as well.
Are you still the president of the NAACP out there?
Still president of the Aurora branch of the NAACP. And just a quick on that Elijah McClain case, the trials for everyone that was involved are coming up, and we'll be monitoring those trials to make sure justice is taking place for his family. His mom is still here. I check in with her periodically, Shanine McClain, and for the community to see justice.
Okay, now we're going to come back to that because that's similar to what we just saw with Tyree Nichols. Rasha Key, who
very
else?
Similar.
All right, Rasha Key, who else?
You have Linda Shorter and Alma J.
Okay.
And Sandra Henderson.
Okay, well, why don't we go with Linda? Linda? Linda, are you there?
Here, I'm here. I was trying to unmute. I'm here. Yes.
Okay. Now you're in Florida, and you've been dealing with a lot of the issues out there. You know, the consciousness. You got a wild governor that want to get rid of African American history AP classes. And you at the same time. Florida is a swing state from a political standpoint. This governor arrested Black people for voting, sent out SWAT and things of this nature. How do you see these issues that are affecting Black people with this type of a governor that is planning on running for president with that type of mentality?
I thank you for that question, but I think I want to divert it to someone our guest panel today. Like, for instance, I want Reginald Muhammad to answer that for me, because he's from Florida.
Okay. Go ahead, Reggie. Hello?
Professor Ryan to the audience. Thank you, Linda, for... And, okay.
Give him more time.
Allow me to answer the question. Ron DeSantis, the governor, what we should expect that, because what you see is a wicked white supremacy system and capitalism in crisis right now. And so their response is going to be that way. We know that we outnumber them all over the world 11 to 1. And so you're going to see reactionary responses from a very conservative group of people. And again, when you had a president like a Donald Trump, and one of the books that I'm working on now is called the Trump Takeover: Politics of a Sadistic Psychopathic President and Population. We have a population of people like that, Professor Ron. So what I really do full time, even though we're doing adjunct work. Can you all hear?
Yeah. You was upside down.
I'm not sure what happened with my phone here. Hold on a minute. But anyway, if y'all can still hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you. We can't hear you now, though.
And then since the sisters, since our we have guests here, the sister that started, do you want to help us out? Do you have an opinion? I know you're in another state, but Ron DeSantis, do you have an opinion of him at all?
Oh, I do. I don't know what that might sound like in polite. No.
Rose, yes. You were down there with the McClain case, Elijah McClain. How is Denver Black community? I mean, you took me, I think that was Four Squares or something where the Black community is.
5 points.
5 points. And then at the same time, it's been a long time understanding of institutional racism. You set up under Francis, you set up under Hakeem Olajuwon, you set up under a lot of the activists. How do you see your Denver community when it comes to racism and this institutional of raising the kid up in a racist dynamic?
And it really depends, Ra, on where you are and who you're connected to. Coming from Los Angeles, Denver is a really interesting place. And Kumba, you can testify to this. When you first get here, you will think it's backwards, that is slow, that the people tend they appear not to be as progressive. But when you step back and really practice cultural humility and get to know the community, you see the power of the community here. We're only, 6% of the population? I may be misquoting that. It depends, on where you are. But this community is so tight-knit. It's unbelievable. Every day, Kumba and I have access to our Black legislators. We have access to the governor. We have access to the DA's office. We have activists who have been at this a very long time. When you talk about Elijah McClain, the only reason you hear as much as you do about Elijah McClain is because of Candace. If it was not for that sister who, before the cameras ever started rolling, And Omar, you could talk about this later. This woman pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. So you have people here, you have activists here who do the work, not because they're going to be in front of a camera, but because it's the right thing to do. My son, born and raised here, his activism was cultivated here because of leaders like Kumba, because of leaders like Brother Jeff, because of legislators, Black legislators who are also activists, who really, really took him under their wing. So he went from activist to community organizer and now in law school to be able to really do what he needs to do from that level in terms of his activism. But because we're such a tight-knit community, the opportunities to impact change, I believe, are greater. Kumba, you want to add on to that?
Yes, and when you talk about Candace Bailey, there was another sister there by the name of Lindsay Mentor. There were several sisters who worked with Janine McClain, as well as her attorney, Mari, to really make sure that the community knew what took place to Elijah McClain. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about the activism, not only just the activism, but also the elected officials, those who hold key positions. We have a Black state legislature that's comprised of about 7 or 8 Black folks that's been elected to office. Our first African immigrant, Nikita Ricks, was elected to office. We have our first sister from, I forget exactly what country she's from the continent, that just got elected to our school board in Aurora Public Schools. We've had Black police chiefs, Black fire chiefs. So we've had Black in Colorado have one of the largest MLK celebrations in the country. So although we only make up maybe about 10 to 12% within the state, that few is very mighty in making sure that Black consciousness is upheld in the state of Colorado, whether if it's in education, whether it's in the community, whether if it's in our politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's beautiful. But You know,
excuse me, Professor Rob.
Yeah.
Are you going to go to Alma?
Her system won't let her talk. But go ahead.
Well, she's able to.
No, but she's not talking. But
okay.
All right. Who else is?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do.
But first of all, let me just say this, Brother Joe. Brother Hembrick, you have any comments before we close out? Brother Hembrick? Let me just say.
Sorry, I was muted. Sorry about that. Appreciating all the guests on the panel tonight, and especially Sister Alma. Sister Alma, this is Mr. Hembrick from Centennial. We used to talk all the time. So I want to give her a special shout out. And I have somewhat of a, you know, I know we're dealing with racism and the child and all of that. And I have another spin on that, you know, because, you know, with the political stuff and all that, like I always state my case, I don't suffer from the illusion of inclusion. You know, we behind enemy lines and whatnot, and we expect certain things to come about. And I'm here to tell you, you get a little inch of something, but that's all you're going to get. But what I want to tap into is when you talk about consciousness, and the brother said, do for self, Brother Muhammad, you know, from Nation Islam, I'm more of a know thyself person, and with the consciousness and from a the village community, getting back to what our ancestors were about. Specifically, you know, we talk about the money and all of that. I know your son was talking about the crypto and all that, but you know, our people were a barter trade. You know, that's how the Africans operated before the invaders came. And so, and they were big about nature. And I know when I was teaching at Centennial, I was big on that, especially with the sun.
All right.
With the activating the pineal gland and that melanin, because that's the reason these races are so racist as they are, because they lack that and they want that. And there's some mutants around the world that's eating black organs trying to get melanin in their bodies. So, you know, I know this is where we are in this country, and, you know, we got to play his game with all of the stuff that's been mentioned. But I just want to say that I think we need to, and I mean, this has been going on for, 400 years now, okay? But I think we need to tap into what our ancient ancestors were about. With nature, especially our kids. These kids don't get outside in nature anymore. They got their little thumbs working on little things. They need to get out in the sun and let that sun hit that pineal gland and activate that melanin, and maybe the ancestors will let them know what they need to be doing. That's the aspect of our history that we don't tap into because we're so assimilated with the, you know, values and culture of where we live. We got to go back to where we came from, I believe, if we're going to go forward. So I'm going to leave it at that, and appreciating what everyone has said this evening, but that's just my perspective from a long study of all of this stuff.
All right, Brother Joe, thanks for that comment. Brother Luther Keith, Sister Alma told me to tell you that she really appreciates all the work you're doing, you and Joe, and especially you, Luther, and she remembers your mom, and she remembers all the work that your mom did, as well as what you're doing, and she just wanted to compliment you on that. Second, Rasha Key, did you have any comments?
Well, I mean, a lot have been said, and I agree with most of it. And I don't even think anything I can disagree with. So I'm just elated that we have this gathering of educators and community members to give us this rich, rich information. So I'm going to pass on speaking this evening. It's just been wonderful.
Well, first of all, let me say, first of all, we deeply appreciate all the guests, and the people that have chimed in, especially Brother Reginald Muhammad, as long as long time activist and one of the leaders in the reparation movement, and along with Dr. Allen, one of the leaders in educational reform and suspension reduction. Brother Kaumba, longtime NAACP brother, one of the presidents of the BSU here at Cal State University of Long Beach when they had their progressive movements, and as well as a hardworking brother throughout the Denver community, not just with Cherry Creek. And he's been working with the law enforcement agencies and governors and secretary of district attorneys and things of this nature to help families when they have problems. He's been him and Sister Gina and all those things. The thing is, Brother and Sister, you know, we appreciate the progress and Brother Principal Ra and their work. As far as trying to really impact those young people. But the dynamic of racism and raising Black children in racism is unique and profound, because most parents do not educate their kids to the reality of racism. You know, being told a kid, watch out for the police, is not dealing with racism alone. That's one dynamic of it. But it's in every aspect of life. That's what we learn. That's what we learn, Dr. Allen, from Frances Gress Wilson. She talked about 9 different areas or something, or 12, 11, and in her book, The ISIS Papers. And so we know that it's more than just the beat down of this young man. It's the system that cultivated that. And in order to combat it, we must educate our young people that what a racist dynamic is. And a racist dynamic is not prejudice. It's not white folks hating you or white folks having more than you and having more opportunities than you. I mean, it's institutional, it's cultural, it's a part of the persona of a minority rule. Europeans are minorities in the world, as Joe Hembrick would say. And and they develop weapons, as Dr. Frances Gress Wilson, and they call them the great equalizer. They impose their will, and at the same time, they are very tricky, as Reginald Muhammad would say, that one of the first leaders of the Black Conscious and Know Thyself movement, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who called them trickeration. Because they're put on TV, people, comedians and people just had Lucille Ball and all that. And they'll lullaby you, like that's their nature. But then Lucille turned around and vote for Trump and vote for Wallace when he was in the South. And they institutionalize it with laws and with like I said during the Latasha Harlan case, when the judge gave the Asian woman probation for the murder of a young lady who just bought some orange juice and things, and they just shot her in the head. Well, I said racism is not her killing her. It's a judge letting them go for killing. These brothers that beat up this young man, we're taught in the African American Culture Center by Dr. Malaka Ringa, there's perpetrators, there's collaborators, and there's victims. And we don't want to be making our kids feel like they're victims all the time, because we want them to be able to combat the challenges that they face that they don't see coming at them: unemployment, lack of opportunities in various areas of education and consciousness. As Brother Principal Ra, he teach the kids, you know, how to get around the obstacles and don't let the obstacles depress you or drive you crazy. And Brother Luther, Keith would tell the homeless people that don't give up hope, you know, even though it seems like you don't have no opportunities out there, there are some if you change. And so my point is that we have to deal with racism from a scientific and educational aspect as well as political and cultural. And so these Black police officers, they were just being American. And it's an American to beat down Black people. And we've had that throughout slavery. They used to make the Blacks whip them. And even Fannie Lou Hamer, they made a Black man beat her to the point that she couldn't have children and that she lost her sight in one eye. And she said, I forgive you because the guy is making you do this. And at the same time, these police people say, well, how could Black people do this? Black, when you're taught self-hate, as Reginald Muhammad was bringing out, it's so subliminal. You don't think you're acting out hatred, but when you decorate yourself and mutilate yourself to look like white folks and thinking that's going to get you over, when you collaborate and like Clarence Thomas and Thomas Sowell and all those that support legislation. See, it's easy for them to share simple things, access. It's hard for them to share power. They'll turn right back around and support what Israel's doing to the Palestinians with weapons and vetoing everything that other countries want to do with regard to labeling them committing genocide on the Palestinians. And then turn around and say, well, you know, we want freedom. We want democracy here. And violence is bad everywhere, you know, when it comes to them, their country. You know, we don't need violence here, you see, and we don't need violence in our politics. We don't need violence on the school campus. We don't need that. But they're the biggest purveyors, as Martin Luther King said, they're the biggest purveyor of violence around the world. Because violence is a part of their defense and offense mechanisms to control the world. I mean, most people just want to live on the planet. I mean, how you call people immigrants? How you put up borders? And how you don't share your wealth and the power that you have to feed the world, clothe the world, and get the homeless off the street? If you can spend trillions of dollars for war, infiltrate, neutralize Black leaderships and all those that advocate peace, how you don't spend that kind of money to get people off the streets or provide more opportunity? They do not want to share. And they use this 3% of the multimillionaires and trillionaires who lobby and pay to protect their interests. And so my point is that what y'all are doing is magnificent because you know the truth, Brother Mashinda, and you're sharing that truth and you're implementing things, even from a sacred way. Sometimes you have to whisper it to these young people. Sometimes you can teach it when you have an all-Black audience. It's like Messianic or the mystery systems and things of this nature about the reality. But what they did to this young man with regards to the beatdown and the murder, until we get all the information, we'll be just speculating and until all the information come out. But at the same time, this has been going on even before Emmett Till. You know, the 100 lynchings and all those types of stuff. Law enforcement was involved in that. The history of the police was the suppression. In white communities, to serve and protect. In Black communities, to serve, protect, and suppress. And so we got to look at that. And the same thing with education. When it comes down to the resources and once you get educated, you know, what do you do with it? And so we look at those of you that's on here, Professor Muhammad, Dr. Allen, Principal Ra, Director Kumba. And but at the same time, you have people that's on the grass, who are on the street level, like Luther Keith, you know, who just, hey, just out there just say, hey, I'm gonna do something with the little resources I got. I don't have no money. I'm just gonna go out and collect clothes and give it to the homeless. You know, we need that. We need all that. We need all, everybody's on deck. And we want to thank all of y'all for coming in, but raising our children.
Professor Rock, can I say something real quick?
Yeah.
So I think it's really important. You know, you said it says some powerful things, and I think it's important that we understand that racism mutates. And racism mutates as systems change. And it will continue. It continues to mutate. But I challenge us, everybody here, and I charge us to really define our roles and define our wins. I'll give you an example, like equity for the work that I do is defined as the redistribution of access and resources to those who most need it, right? And when I charge young people, it's important for them to know the sacred knowledge that you do speak about and that we all know. However, this new generation, we must challenge them to creatively think of how we solve these problems. And it's really important that we charge them in those different ways off of, well, not only what's practical, but taking something that's complex and simplifying it for them to be able to be problem solvers towards it. It goes back to saying, like, if we allow them to feed us, we also allow them to starve us. And it's been a starvation of education. It's been a starvation of liberation. It's been a starvation to all that. And I'm saying that to say is because, you know, in many cases, we need legislation. I think there was a brother talking about, you know, it was starting at the top from state levels of all across the country. And, you know, they say a lot of times, you know, affluent white people, they lobby while we vote, right? And if we understand and we really study the data off of, you know, the ages of 18 to 24, they're the number one demographic that's not voting. If you look at that age demographic, they're not voting, and that's an alarming rate. So what does that tell us? That means the future of voting is very limited if we don't do something about it, right? If we don't creatively think around that. And I think it's important for us, if we think about liberation and we think about Black education in America's schools, is for us to really bridge the gap of information, bridge the gap of education, but bridge the gap of creative implementation. And that could be looked at in different ways. Like, there's different groups that we can create the Nguzo Saba teaching development curriculum in regards of the seven principles of building an equitable leader. Let's be honest. There's only 2% of Black educators in K-12 education. Black males, I would say, specifically Black males, right? And we think about also the high incarceration rate of Black males. We think about the high levels of Black males that's not in the household. That is important. So I just want to echo that in regards to what you said, Professor Raw, that racism mutates. It's understand that some of the work of Dr. Roland Fryer, of course, that I mentioned, but Jeff Duncan Andrade out here, Critical Hope, right? When you think about Critical Hope in our schools, we must not allow hope to be a lie that kids tell themselves to keep going, right? We want to create something that's powerful.
But even see, it's also...
Professor Roth?
Yes, go ahead, Brother Reza.
Yes, real quick, one of the things I want to share too, though, Professor Roth, collectively, what is it that how do we finally stem the tide and turn the tide of racism? And how do we finally put our people in the position where we're strategically fit and successful for the remainder of the 21st century? And when we start talking about the restoration, transformation, and finally the elevation of Black life, where we can measure that now from the next 5 to 10, 15, 20, 25 years, you're talking complete reparations. How do we define complete reparations? That's what I do at the National Reparations Institute here in Atlanta. It's first off, the process by which a nation of people is provided with the means to repair, restore their condition, achieve complete decolonization, make themselves whole through the ability to self-govern, self-sustain, self-defend with their own independent landmass, economy, education, culture, and high civilization. Now, one of the things, Professor Roth, one of the gentlemen just talked about public policy. Well, at the end of the day, public policy, if it's going to be meaningful and impactful for Black folks, the masses now, we're all doing programs and processes around the country, but how do we harness all of that together, where the masses of our people now If we say that we have a homeless population throughout the country, not just in Los Angeles, but we got 7,000 to 8,000 Black people in Atlanta that are homeless. Everywhere you have a major city in America, you got Black people homeless. You got Black people who have been systematically locked out, locked under and locked under and locked in for generations to come. How do we answer that now that will make us, again, put us in the position that now we finally say that we have eradicated, we see the homeless numbers come down, the poverty come down, the incarceration rate come down, the lack of education and higher education come down. How do we sustain historically Black colleges and perpetuate to make sure that they are sustainable and successful for the remainder of the 21st century? How do we answer the situation with Black farmers that have never been paid? How do we answer the question with Black independent schools that we need all over the country? Now you're talking complete reparations. And Professor Roth, for your guests and everybody on the line, we will be having the third annual National Reparations Indaba here at the Atlanta University Center at the end of June. And again, this is how we do it collectively. And again, if we do it collectively, we can measure 5 years from down the road, 10 years, 15, 20, 25 years, we can start to see these numbers come down. And we can start because, again, that is done with the collective culture model. You're right, brother. When I was on talking with you earlier, I had not shared with you all. But yeah, there is a model and a methodology that has to be in place. Protesting, picketing, prayer breakfasts, and pleading with Europeans, that would not solve our problem. And our problem, again, it will end up being public policy. And again, what does that public policy looks like, and what will be sustainable and successful for Black folks for the remainder of the 21st century? You're talking complete reparations. And so I just wanted to share that with you all. And again, the National Reparations Declaration is out. So you can get it at your bookstores in certainly in Los Angeles area, 30-something bookstores carry. You can go online and find it. But at the end of the day, Ray Wimbush, he said his 40 years in the movement, he had never seen a better calculation than what we had provided. And again, if you pick up the declaration, you know who owes us, why they owe us, how much they owe us, and why reparations is good for all of Black America. The model and the methodology is there too. That's what has been missing in the reparations movement for a whole 100 years. Where's the model and your methodology? A 10-point program is not a model and a methodology for securing reparations. If you tell me you're going to build a building in Los Angeles, California, and again, you keep telling me you're building a building, residential or commercial, at some point, somebody's going to ask you, where's the blueprint? Because you can't even break ground and build the building. You can't go through zoning or planning and get any permits in Los Angeles for residential or commercial building unless you have a blueprint. So finally, we have a blueprint in the reparations movement, and that is the National Reparations Declaration. So I employ those of y'all who would get a chance to read it. And again, if the brother's standing on the corner, he's in corporate America, if he's on the campus, he will read it and say, okay, you know what? You have clearly defined what complete reparations is. First off, who owe us, why they owe us, how much, and why reparations becomes essential for all of Black America. If we're talking about finally the restoration, transformation, and the elevation of Black life, we're talking about the masses of the people now.
There are a number of issues that you say that are so correct. Yeah, and I commend the people that are pushing the reparation movement and you are at the forefront with the declaration. But at the same time, we must win the hearts and minds of our people.
Absolutely.
And winning the hearts and minds of our people means that we need a revolution, cultural revolution within, and absolutely, a political revolution without.
Yes, sir.
Every one of you I asked to be here because I know that you have done that with your families. You have educated your families to race consciousness and reality. Dr. Allen's son is one of the premier activists in the Denver area, right there in the forefront. He went to Howard, graduated. Now he's in law school. But he's conscious. Conscious. Yes, he's going to have children, and he will teach them. Each one teach one, as Joe say. We have to build from the bottom up because we're talking about trying to build not only a reparation movement, but a Black conscious movement and a drive toward personal ethical and values within the youth. In other words, I grew up hard, you know, fighting all the time, gang leader, gang fighter, all of that. But none of my kids did. You know, I have six children because I taught them not to do that from home.
That's right.
My mother and father just said, hey, go. You know, I'm going to the park. No instruction, no, don't get in trouble. But at the same time, they would say, anybody mess with you, you knock the hell out of them and run home. You understand? And all that time, pick up a stick, throw at them and do whatever you got to do. They were from the South. We have more educated people than before that are producing conscious kids. It's a long, protracted struggle.
Yes, sir.
It took hundreds of years to get out of slavery. It's going to take us hundreds of years to educate a cadre of you, because when you say, know thyself, and I said, we're going to get back to that.
Yes, sir.
There is resistance within the community to know thyself and be able to implement what you know about yourself into practice. Knowing yourself don't mean nothing. Knowing history don't mean nothing. It's what you learn from it and how you learn the lessons of progress from history and the lessons of failure so you don't repeat them. But you, Dr. Allen, Brother Kaumba, Brother Principal Rod took his daughter, who ain't even out of elementary school, to the Black College Expo the other day. I said, where you at? He said, I'm at the Black College Expo. We just wanted to bring my daughter down here to get her started.
That's right.
Think of that. You know, Dr. Allen kids was expected to go to college.
That's right.
Wasn't a choice. You understand? My kids were cultivated. We was on top of their grades at home.
That's right.
Now, you got to do that as a single parent. You got to do that as a foster home parent. We got to get strategies to produce an atmosphere of growth and development and consciousness. You got to teach your people that you don't fight unless it's self-defense.
That's right.
You don't use drugs. You don't use alcohol. You don't do those things. And the only thing I'm trying to say is that y'all are successful. Brother Mashinda, you know, he worked with you. He see what they do bad. He incorporates it, and he teaches all that who he can not to do it, just like you're teaching them about reparation. That's a beautiful thing. But then the white guy say, no, it ain't about reparations, it's about hip-hop. You're free not to be Black. You can be gay. You can put earrings on as a man, and you can do that. You free.
Yeah.
You can go to Taco Bell or Jack in Box. You free. You understand? Forget health eating. You know, nutrition. You understand my point to you?
Yes, sir.
That we as educators and trainers, coaches, like Principal Rod did at the U, you got to touch the inner soul of our people, win their hearts and minds, as Dr. Karanga said. And I just want to say that we're going to continue this discussion, and we want to thank all of you for being on. And I know it's late in Atlanta, late in Denver, and it's really getting late here because, you know, I got a health issue I got to deal with early in the morning. So I just want to let Rasha Key tell you what's coming on Wednesday. Thank each of you. Brother Luther, make sure you get my number from Joe Hembrick. I got a whole bunch of clothes. I'm finna clean my closet completely out. They're for big men. I got shoes, clothes, suits. I'm not even wearing suits no more. If it ain't a dashiki or just a pants and shirt, I'm not putting no more ropes around my neck.
Gotcha.
You understand? Call ties. You understand? None of that. You understand? So all I'm saying is that let's work together as a network. I'm urging everybody to get your book, The Declaration of Reparations, Black revolutionary school culture, Principal Robel, Dr. Allen's articles, she's featured in Albany Magazine. Read, as you said. So, Brother Rasha Key, take us on home.
All right. Thanks a lot, everybody. It's been an excellent evening. Very informational, very inspiring. Now, on Wednesday, we have my granddaughter on. She's 11-year-old, and I'm going to interview her. I have about 3 to 4 questions from some of the community members, and we're going to have fun with her and get her on here to talk about what she does as 11-year-old. So that's exciting for me. And then also on Saturday, we have another special edition. We just had Priestess Victorious from Ghana on Sunday. That was a real good show. Now we're going to have an internationally known person from the United States and Jamaica. Yeah, and I don't want to mention no names. This is a pretty powerful brother. His father was major, and I ain't going to mention no names, so I'm just going to let that ride. You guys can, if you're interested, check out the website. That's how I'm going to do this one. So, yeah, that's what's going on. Professor Ron, anything for Monday of next week?
We're going to try to have a representative from Black Lives Matter on.
That'll be wonderful.
He's one of the leaders of the L.A. They had a couple of shootings in L.A. that we're going to be discussing. And plus, we're going to get back and discuss the Tyree Nichols. His mom was such a powerful spiritual person dealing with this. When the way she then laid it out, I mean, it's just, and his father. We don't deal with stepfathers, as they say, they fathers, period. And we're going to have them on. And all those are songs is welcome to check back on Monday at 6. And we're going to be dealing, my whole thing is, we can give our people reparations. And I know Dr. Allen does, and I know Brother Kalumba, our men was giving them reparations, educational reparations, by giving truth. And like when I was teaching at Cal State Long Beach, the reason I passed so many people is reparations. You understand? Keep in school long enough to mature and realize, hey, I can graduate, But you have to, with the resources you have, and things of this nature, there's forms of reparations that we can give. But we are after the monetary reparations, Brother Mom. Don't get me wrong. And we are after the justice reparations. And we are after that declaration that you have, that plan that you have. And I think that everybody should read that plan, because it's one of the most comprehensive. And we're going to feature it again. We're going to have you on just on reparations again with regards to the declaration, because we think more people should be aware of your book, as well as what you're doing as a leader in that field. All right. Great. So, brother.
Thank you.
Okay. And man, everybody, good night. And we deeply appreciate all y'all for being on. Thanks a lot. And just, we'll be on YouTube. So if you want to direct people to it, just go to Community Education Network. And then they'll have a list of all you put the website, and it'll be on all that, and you can direct people. So, okay, good night to everybody.
Good night.
All right.